1039 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. Feldis and Kale proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Dan, how are you today?
I'm great. Ken, how are you?
I am doing very well, and I know you had a brief sabbatical last week on the seacoast. Did you have a good time?
It was great. We had family in town. We're in Hampton Beach, and went all around the state, and also went to Fisher Cats game. Got to see you there, and Iris and Josie got to throw out the first pitch at the Fisher Cats game, which was quite a treat. And they did a great job. Josie really threw it in there.
She really did. It was a great night. Great weather wise. Unfortunately, the Fisher Cats lost, but great fireworks display after the game for sure.
Great fireworks display, and it's always a great time at Northeast Delta Dental Stadium. So, folks who are listening, get down, check out a game. Fisher Cats, they got some good prospects. Their catcher in particular is really good.
Oh, my goodness, he is. He hit a grand slam the night that we were there. Our guest today on Feldis and Kale is New Hampshire State Senator from District 13, Cindy Rosenwald, and a Democrat representing 6 of Nashua's 9 wards since 2018. Senator Rosenwald serves on the Senate Capital Budget, Executive Departments and Administration, and Finance Committees. That would make you, Cindy, a very busy person.
Well, good morning.
I am busy. We've actually had a change in committee assignments, and this term I've been on Finance and Ways and Means, so I've been able to see how the money comes in and how it goes out.
Well, very good. But you're still busy. There's no doubt about that.
I am really busy.
Right. Well, the Senate recently passed the state budget. Republicans, talked about the virtues of the budget. But Democrats said, not so fast. Senator Rosenwald, we only have an hour on this show today. What don't you like about the budget?
Well, there are things that I do like about the budget, but there's a lot that worries me. I think this is my 6th state budget that I've worked on. I have never seen a more extremist budget. We refer to it as Robin Hood in reverse, because not so much in this next budget, but in 2 or 3 budgets down the road, we are going to see a constricting of resources that will lead to cutbacks in state programs and forced increases in local budgets and property taxes. And I don't think that is the right direction for New Hampshire. Specifically, I'm very concerned about the tax cuts that in the next budget are going to cost $130 million of state funds and some unknown amount of federal funds. In particular, we have, for no good reason at all, and I have to say the Republicans cannot even defend it, the complete elimination of the interest and dividends tax over the next 5 years. This is a tax that probably many people in New Hampshire aren't even aware exists. It's paid for by fewer than 10% of the state's population, but it generates close to $140 million a year. And eliminating this tax will not benefit people who might pay a little bit because they've managed to save and invest in the stock market or in financial savings accounts, and maybe they pay a couple hundred dollars a year in this tax. But about 15 people in New Hampshire who have assets over $350 million will receive practically the entire benefit. So about 2.5% of the filers are currently paying half of the tax. That is just a very steep pyramid in how this tax gets paid. There is no good reason to repeal it. It helps most the people who have been smart, wise, and lucky over their careers, and they didn't even ask for this elimination of the tax. But it's going to hurt the rest of the Granite State. So I'm very concerned about that. There's a cut in the in the rooms and meals tax, small cut in the percentage from 9% to 8.5%. I like to think of it as if I go to the common man and order a BLT, I'll save a nickel on that sandwich. But my nickel and your nickel and everybody's nickels that we save one sandwich at a time adds up to $30 million lost in the budget over the next 2 years alone. So we are not helping average Granite Staters who are struggling to pay their expenses, pay their property taxes, worry about finding a place to live, affording child care, and having good schools for their kids. But we're helping the people at the very top, the wealthiest individuals, biggest multinational corporations who are already doing very well. So I'm concerned about that as my first issue with the budget. I think it underfunds public education. We are not helping the property poorest towns, but we are giving a tax cut, one-time tax cut, to the wealthiest property towns in the state. That doesn't make sense to me. The Senate had added coverage to expand the Medicaid program to include dental care, very important. 34 states do this already, and the Senate was unanimous. We edited it to the budget. We paid for it. And the House refused to go along, and the Senate Republicans caved to the House. I think that's a disservice to over 100,000 Granite Staters, people who have developmental disabilities, people who are elderly and in nursing homes or staying in their community with support. Our Medicaid expansion individuals who are very low income, if you have a mouthful of poor teeth or missing teeth, it's going to be very hard for you to get a good job that can pull you out of poverty. So I think that was a missed opportunity. The budget also starts up the most expansive school voucher program in the country. I'm worried about sending public tax dollars to private and religious schools and even to homeschool families. There is almost no income accountability for this program and no accountability for these for-profit companies that can get paid by this program. And there's no responsibility for making sure that they're delivering good services to New Hampshire's children. So I don't like the cutting of the elimination of state funds for the family planning program. I think we're likely to find that people are having cancer diagnosed later. People are going to lose access to contraception. That's going to end up in more unplanned pregnancies and higher costs in the Medicaid program. Down the road, that's certainly going to hurt us. And I don't like the arbitrary ban on later-term abortions. And it really ignores the rare suffering of families.
So other than mandated ultrasounds for abortions that remain legal after the budget, a ban on abortions late in pregnancy, a cutting the family planning budget affecting 15,000 Granite Staters, cutting child care, increasing property taxes, cutting taxes for the wealthiest 1%, and big corporations, sending public tax dollars to private prep schools and religious schools, banning discussions about systemic racism. Is there anything good in this budget,
yes.
Cindy?
There is. Honestly, there's complete funding for the developmental disabilities program. That is funded. We've increased Medicaid rates for nursing homes and the community-based care programs, and I think that's really good. We did add some funding for mental health. Some of it is just straight out good. Some of it is good, but with an asterisk, such as removing the prohibitions on private prison companies running the secure psychiatric unit, the forensic hospital. But we did manage to fund the waste water and clean water grants, which the House had cut. These were commitments that the state has been making for years to local communities for projects that are required by the federal government. The cities and towns have to pay for these projects, and when they're complete, the state helps pay back some of the loans that the cities and towns have taken out. So we did restore that. We added money to the highway fund, which is important. And as cars get more efficient or electric, that those funding sources are not keeping up. So there are good things in the budget, but in House Bill 2, Robin Hood in reverse, there are items like divisive concepts, like the abortion ban, that don't even have any relation to the budget. And then there are big, expensive items like school vouchers that never had a financial review.
Our guest is State Senator Cindy Rosenwald of Nashua. We have to take a quick break here, but we'll be back and talk more about the impending vote in the House of the state budget, which was passed by the Senate. It's Feldis and Kale, 103.9, 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Proudly presented by your local New Hampshire dairy farmers and Granite State Dairy Promotion. 103.9, 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Welcome back, Feldis and Kale, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Our guest today is State Senator Cindy Rosenwald from Nashua, a Democrat representing six of Nashua's nine wards since 2018. We're talking about the state budget, which passed in the Senate, but will now go on to the House on Thursday. And if you would, for a moment, Cindy or Senator Rosenwald, tell us about the school voucher plan. Tell us just a little bit more about that.
Right. So this would enable any child whose family income is more than 300% of the federal poverty level to be given the state's adequacy payment for that child and their family to use to help pay tuition at an expensive private school or a pretty expensive religious school, or to keep and homeschool. And it's particularly problematic that the means testing, the assurance that the family's income is no higher than moderate, is only conducted once. So if you have a kindergartner and your family income is 250% of federal poverty, let's say, you can get that payment for your child, which is about $4,500 or $4,600 a year on average. But you only have to prove that income once. So the next year you get a better job or you win the lottery or, you know, you inherit money, you never have to prove again that you are not more affluent. And you can continue to get that state adequacy payment for the next 12 years of your child's education. That is, I can't even think of it, another state program where there are no financial controls. For example, in the Medicaid program, people are asked to prove their income at least once a year.
How does it impact the funding for public schools?
Well, there was no financial analysis done on this program. The Senate Republicans refused to send the bill to the Finance Committee, but there are estimates that it could cost $60 million when fully up and running. It's going to also impact local property taxes because when one child leaves a public school system, if there are any savings at all, there will be only marginal savings because that district is not going to need to have one fewer teacher, one fewer classroom, one fewer school bus. So there are really essentially no savings when a child leaves the school system, but $4,600 walks out the door. So the district is still going to have the cost, but they won't get the payment. Well, it's also going to cost the state education trust fund, because when that child leaves organized education for homeschooling, that money leaves the system entirely and goes directly to the family.
It'll cost state funding, no doubt about it, and that will
Definitely local funds as well. The Department of Education tried to suggest that there would be huge savings, as if
any
child
sense.
Leaving a public school would save the entire adequacy payment, but that just is nonsensical.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. But I mean, the biggest thing for me, I think, on this is the lack of control, lack of accountability, just fraught and ripe for waste, fraud, and abuse with taxpayer money, public taxpayer money being shuffled off without any accountability.
Right. I mean, there's, you know, for a family that has four children, we're talking $20,000 a year of state funds going to a family who may or may not use that money to educate their children. There is no accountability. I like to believe that homeschool families have their children's best interests at heart, but we really have no idea how that money would be spent. And on the for-profit institutions that aren't going to be able to skim 10% of the money off the top, there's no accountability at all.
None. I mean, this is,
it's shocking.
State auditors in other states where this has been proposed, Ken, have said this is a problem. I mean, this is an accounting problem. Shifting gears a little bit, paid family medical leave insurance, so critical for working families, attracting and retaining young working families in the state. We have a workforce issue. It's critical to that. It's critical to leveling the playing field between small businesses and big corporations and hiring, our caretaking crisis, combating the opioid and mental health epidemic, and of course, dealing with this pandemic or a future pandemic. Paid family and medical leave insurance, had it been in place and not vetoed by Governor Sununu, would have helped working people and families get by. And what we've seen in HB2, Senator Rosenwald, is, you know, Senate Republicans plopped in what I'll call fake family leave. But it suffers from many of the same flaws that the naysayers of paid family leave have said existed all along, including if you considered the prior efforts of paid family leave a quote-unquote income tax, you'd have to consider the language in HB2 an income tax too.
I totally agree with you. This this fake family leave program that the governor proposed, the House took out, the Senate put it back in, and stayed in the end, really is the status quo. It doesn't really do anything, but on the state employee side, it is paid for with tax dollars, so it clearly is an income tax if you thought that paid family leave was an income tax. I never thought it was, and I think it would have been very helpful in the pandemic. We saw that women were disproportionately likely to leave the workforce over the past year. That's bad for the employment situation in New Hampshire. But long term, if you think about financial security of women, if you are not working, you are not paying into Social Security. And to the extent that you short yourself on Social Security when you're younger and of working age, you become more likely to be impoverished when you are elderly. And that's a problem for New Hampshire because it means that you're much more likely to end up on Medicaid when you're older, and that clearly is an income tax on the back end.
No doubt about it. And the other thing that I think has generated some interest and controversy in HB2, in addition to all the things we just talked about, is the so-called emergency powers of the governor. Now, there's all this talk about how the language in there curtails the emergency powers of the governor, but as I read it, Senator Rosenwald, it doesn't. And in fact, it has two different, there's some notice provisions, no doubt, to be sure. The governor's got to provide some notices. But this notion that now you can have a vote to end a declared state of emergency, that was the law already by resolution, and it was only a Senate rule that required two-thirds votes on resolutions that prohibited that. You can change the Senate rule. You don't have to change the statute. That's not a compromise. So for those out there listening who's concerned about emergency powers of the governor, I don't think this curtails it at all.
Well, I'm still getting a lot of email about this from people across New Hampshire. I have to say, not really people in my district, but people in other parts of the state who see through that and wanted us to vote to keep the stricter House position.
Yeah. Well,
The conference negotiators elected not to do that.
That was part of the concern of the House Freedom Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
That
which is big.
Yeah. How many members of that?
We don't know for sure, excuse me, but I consistently hear that it's between 50 and 80 members of the House Republican Caucus.
Yeah, and Senator Rosenwald, I know you got to run in a few minutes by 10, but I would say that, look, I can, Senator Rosenwald, I might have been the only candidate ever to run for governor, pledging to relinquish powers of the governor. And it makes sense because unilateral government is not conducive to democracy. It's not conducive to good results. And it's not consistent with our Constitution. And so this window dressing of quote-unquote emergency powers in HB2, if you're concerned about it, you got to vote that down. Another thing that's in there that's a big government mandate, Senator Rosenwald, we talked about it briefly, is the mandate on ultrasounds, a government-mandated ultrasounds. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So the way the language in House Bill 2 reads, it requires a mandatory ultrasound before any abortion can be performed, while the bill prohibits later-term abortions. It requires an ultrasound for any abortion, and that is not the medical standard of care. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says that for very early abortions, ultrasounds are unnecessary in a lot of cases. So because they're medically not necessary, private insurance and even the Medicaid program are unlikely to pay for them. And that ultrasound can cost up to just about $1,500. Now, we know that people who are lower moderate income to begin with are not going to be able to come up with that kind of money. So it's a huge barrier to care, and it really cuts right at low and moderate income women in New Hampshire.
I just don't. This is wild to me. I mean, regardless of where you're at on the issue of choice, number one, putting something like this in the budget, tacking it on at the 11th hour. Number two, a government mandate of a specific medical procedure. It's intrusion. It's inconsistent with the New Hampshire way. I don't get it. What has been the explanation about why this was put in there?
There has really been no explanation. And some people have asked me if I thought it was a drafting error. I don't have any idea, but I rather think it isn't. And I think probably the drafters in the House knew exactly what they were doing, understood how big a barrier to someone being able to really access their constitutional right in all cases. The legislature should not be setting standards of medical care, period.
Right.
We don't do it, and we shouldn't do it. Doctors should do it.
Well, there's certainly, and there's also, we haven't even talked about it, but there's also a cut to child protection staffing. We have a abuse and neglect crisis in the state. DCYF independent audit in 2016. In the majority, Senator Rosenwald, myself, and others fully funded that staffing, but that's been cut in this budget. What's the status of that?
Yes, so I think we've added back half of the child protection workers that are needed and in the first year. And then there's a provision to allow, if all of those jobs are filled, it allows the department to come back in the second year and request funding for the other 10 that are not funded. But, of course, there are no guarantees at all.
Well, that's progress, and certainly the administration's new administration needs to hire these workers if they they need to prioritize child protection.
Well, the department came to the Senate and said, yes, we still need those 22 child protection workers that the governor defunded.
That's
the negotiators on the conference, not me, but the rest of them wouldn't fully fund them.
So the big vote comes up very soon in the House. And do you have a prediction, Senator Rosenwald?
I believe that the conference reports will pass the Senate, but I don't have a prediction for the House.
And again, the Freedom Caucus could make a big difference there. I mean, they're not happy that the cutback of the governor's emergency powers don't go far enough. That's one of the things they're interested in. I guess
they don't like the family leave program either.
Yeah, and I understand that former House Speaker Bill O'Brien has been recruited to try and twist their arms a little bit.
Nothing surprises me. I have children. Nothing surprises me anymore.
There you go. Well, Senator, thank you so much for being on. I know you got to run, and really appreciate you coming on and talking about the budget that's going to be voted on Thursday. And thank you for all that you do.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Senator. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye. That is Senator Cindy Rosenwald of Nashua. And do you have any prognostications? How should I put my money on this, Dan?
Oh boy, well,
are the odds?
I think I think you can anticipate that the vote in the state Senate on House Bill 1 and 2 will be 14-10 on both of them, along party lines. And then in the House, you know, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think it's going to be close. It's going to be close. And you could see a world where HB2 doesn't pass and HB1 does pass. But we'll find out.
It's interesting because if the Republicans have a majority of what, 212 to 186? Is that what it is?
That sounds about right. It might be give or take one or two here or there.
Right. Yep. So I saw somewhere if there was a full attendance in the House on Thursday, just 13 members of the Freedom Caucus, if they vote no, the budget doesn't pass.
Well, look, I mean, if they're concerned about emergency powers, this objective, and I wrote a piece for the New Hampshire Journal, this does not do anything on emergency powers. To be sure, like I said, there are new notices. The governor, whatever the governor may be, Democrat, Republican, whoever it may be, has to provide additional notice to the legislature. But that's not substantive change, Ken. That's not. You know, and it sort of codifies the view of existing statute by New Hampshire Superior Court judge. So it's not, this is not change. And so if you're concerned about emergency powers, which again, I've been writing about it, been talking about it. You know, I've long advocated for the legislature to reassert itself. I don't think it's consistent with our Constitution. I don't think it's consistent with New Hampshire that one person, regardless of who he or she may be, has that much authority to basically unilaterally pass laws, unilaterally spend over $1.25 billion in federal relief money. That's not consistent with New Hampshire. We have a long, proud bipartisan tradition of working together across party, across branches of government to do the people's work. And that's how you get good results for the people. You end up in a situation where you get no-bid contracts to corporate campaign donors and stuff like that if there's no accountability. So, look, I think that the, you know, I've long talked about it. I agree with the libertarians. The emergency powers need to be cut back. They're not in this particular piece of legislation, House Bill 2. And I understand, as Senator Rosenwald pointed out, that they're concerned about family leave. As the author of paid family and medical leave insurance, Ken, and looking at the language they put in the House Bill 2, well, they borrowed, you know, imitation's the greatest form of flattery. They borrowed a lot of my language, but they put it in kind of a haphazard, hodgepodge kind of way. And if you're going to say that the stuff that I worked on, if folks are going to be out there claiming, as they did in this last election, this bogus claim that paid family and medical leave insurance is somehow, in their view, an income tax, well, then you got to say the same thing about the language in House Bill 2. And you got to be consistent. Otherwise, you're checking your credibility at the door.
So how often are the governor's emergency powers used? I mean, is
very rarely.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
But, you know, look, Ken, I can tell you that Governor Lynch, Governor Benson, when they invoked the emergency powers for different emergencies, the floods and stuff like that, they went to the legislature. Again, we have a bipartisan tradition, regardless of who the governor was. They went to the legislature to authorize spending. They went to the fiscal committee under those emergency declarations. The joint fiscal committee of the legislature, Democrats and Republicans, worked with them to authorize expenditures. That didn't happen. In fact, Governor Sununu broke that long bipartisan tradition. It spent over $1 billion, over $1 billion on his own. Now, of course, he'd say, well, I had a committee that gave me advice and all this other stuff. But his own emergency orders actually say, regardless of what this committee says, you get to do whatever you want to do. And that's what he did. And Ken, again, like I said, and I've written a column with former Senate Majority Leader Bob Clegg, a Republican, and I've talked about this ad nauseum. It doesn't matter who the person is or what party they are. One person government is not consistent with our Constitution. It's not consistent with who we are.
We will continue. We will take a quick break here. It's Feldis and Kale, 1039 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Glad to have you with us today. And proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Welcome back. We are Feldis and Kale at 103.9 1450 WKXL and htalkradio.com. We are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. A big event in the state, Dan, is coming up this Saturday in Concord at White Farm, which is located at 144 Clinton Street in Concord. And you can get just about anything you want, not at Alice's Restaurant, but at the New Hampshire State Surplus Auction.
The State Surplus Auction, it's, you know, if you want to...
It's coming up. It's,
take a look at it. I mean, if you like garage sales, you'll love this.
You know, absolutely. Now, I'm reading from a piece done by Paula Tracy from InDepthNH.org, so I want to give her full credit for this. But there are guns, kayaks, motorcycles, used school buses. You could live in one of those. Not you, but maybe I should consider it. Vacuums, dust collectors, and rolling hospital chairs on the auction block. Now, Governor Sununu and the Executive Council were recently made aware of the upcoming annual auction, which brings in many thousands of dollars to the state when department heads push the used stuff out the door. Cruisers, Arrows, tractors, coin-operated washing machines, they are all on the auction block. So through the Department of Administrative Services, the Thrifty Yankee event was supposed to be online only for the first time this year. Executive Councilor David Wheeler told the council recently, but an online posting by auctioneer James St. Jean on Monday indicated that there had been a change, and the auction will be live only, with pre-bid webcast bidding taking place this year after the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic seems to have passed. And there are going to be no frozen carcasses auctioned off this year. I know you'll be disappointed to hear that, Dan, but no frozen carcasses. But it's going to be a live event. It begins at 8:30. And it's June the 26th, which is this Saturday. No rifles for sale this year, by the way. And such weapons are contingent on all federal and state laws pertaining to the sale of firearms, and they may be picked up on June 28th at the barn in Salisbury, prepaid with cash, credit card, or check. And in all, there are 534 items up for sale this year, and...
But no frozen carcasses.
No frozen carcasses this year. Plows, cruisers, fire trucks, many, many items for sportsmen. Have you ever attended this event?
I have not. I've been to White Farm, but what's the address again on Clinton Street so folks know?
The average is, the address is 144 Clinton Street, White Farm on Clinton Street. Frozen bears, bobcats and beavers were on the block for the annual auction as a way for the state to cash in a bit on the animals' misfortune, supposedly to benefit natural history education. But it was also a deal for taxidermists and those who wanted to mount the heads of the critters on their camp walls. But none of that this year. The event was made world famous by Yankee Magazine when it wrote in the 1980s that the state was so frugal it was auctioning off its roadkill. So there you go.
Yeah.
So you know what? I am almost tempted to go to this.
Let's check it out.
Probably not to buy anything, but just to check out who goes, and
they could go and report back on on our next show.
That's right. So that is Saturday. It starts at 8:30. White Farm at 144 Clinton Street in Concord, but no more roadkill.
No frozen carcasses. I'll be out of town at a wedding, unfortunately, so I'm not going to be able to make it.
Won't
but
be able to attend.
You're going to need to go and report back, Ken.
You know, maybe I will. Maybe I will. Should be a lot of fun. I just like to see the people who show up at these things.
Ought to be interesting.
It should be. We'll have to take our final break as we head down the home stretch. It's Feldis and Kale at 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. We are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. It is Feltus and Kale. We're at 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. And we are proudly presented by a Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And we want to thank our guest in the earlier portion of this show, Cindy Rosenwald. We'll have the big vote in the House on the budget coming up on Thursday. You know, not that it's going to make an impact on anybody else or the TV ratings, but I, for one, I am going to boycott the Summer Olympics this year. I am not going to watch any of it, none of it. Not a minute, unless it's by accident.
And what?
Unless I flip it on the wrong station. But
there you go. What drove you to this conclusion?
I'll tell you what drove me to it. And, you know, it's the fact that they're allowing, well, at least one transgender athlete into the competition. I just don't think it's right. They'll be featuring a transgender weightlifter in the women's competition. Laurel, formerly Gavin Hubbard of New Zealand. Now, she's 39 years old, and in her first competition, won easily, lifting 42 pounds, more than the runner-up in that event, and setting four records along the way. I mean, that's just a small example of how it is just not right for transgender athletes to be involved in the women's or girls' competition in sports, whether it be the Olympics or a local high school event or a college track meet or any kind of athletic endeavor. It's just not right. It really is not. Just think about these women in Olympic competition specifically here, because that's what we're talking about, who have been training for years and years, no matter what the sport is, to get to the pinnacle of their, you know, their athletic, you know, their athletic powers, you know, by training so hard for years and years. And then they throw a transgender into the mix, and it just, you know, just about eliminates, you know, in this case, weightlifters that have been training for years and years and years for this competition. It's not right. It's just not right.
Tell us how you really feel, Ken.
Yeah, well, that's... And, you know, I feel the same way. I feel bad because we see that there have been a lot of girls athletes in track and field in particular that have been robbed of scholarships in many cases. And Connecticut has had probably more than any other state that fall under this example. And they've lost scholarships as a result of states, municipalities allowing these transgender athletes to compete against them. It's just not right.
Well, I mean, generally speaking, we got a lot of work to do to build a full and inclusive society, including transgendered youth and in sports. And so it's a big, complicated debate and topic, but, you know, the arc of inclusion, we need to continue down that road. I think part of inclusion, too, Ken, is talking about the real-world consequences, as we just did early in this program, of this state budget. It's the only piece of legislation that directly impacts everybody in the state. It's going to be voted on Thursday.
Yeah. Nope.
And look, I feel there are some good things in it. You know, the affordable housing, we didn't talk about that. Some of the DD wait list is developmental disability wait list is fully funded. Some of the mental health components, excuse me. However, not fully funding child protection, cutting child care, raising property taxes, sending public tax dollars without accountability to private prep schools, to people who already can afford private prep schools. You probably don't need extra money from the government, and especially at the expense and on the backs of property taxpayers who are taking it on the chin. Tax cuts for the wealthiest, not people like you and me, Ken. We're not getting tax cuts in this budget. It's big corporations. It's the wealthiest 1%. And then a whole bunch of social issues just tacked onto the budget. Regardless of your view of these social issues, plucking them into the budget? No. Come on now. No. I mean, this just doesn't make any sense. So this is, I don't get it. It just sounds like pure politics to me. and it's not a workable budget for Granite Staters.
We will stay on top of this issue and all the breaking issues that affect our lives here on Feldes and Kale. Thank you for joining us on 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion.